This is Gavel to Gavel Alaska, with coverage of the Alaska State Legislature on the statewide 360 North Public Affairs Channel and on the web at www.gavelalaska.org. Gavel Alaska is sponsored by
your capital city celebrating 50 years of Alaska statehood, Juneau, your capital every day.
The Juneau Chamber of Commerce, supporting economic diversity and responsible and sustainable development, and encouraging Alaskans to look local first when buying goods and services.
The Association of Alaska School Boards, helping local school districts provide a quality education focused on student achievement. Bartlett Regional Hospital, providing quality health care and health promotion for the people of Juneau and communities of northern Southeast Alaska.
This special broadcast of U.S. Senator Mark Begich's address to the Alaska State Legislature is produced by 360 North, Gavel, Alaska, in Juneau. I'm Rosemary Alexander, KTOO News Director. In just a few moments, Senator Begich will be speaking to a joint session of the Alaska House of Representatives and the Senate from the state capitol in Juneau. Right now, legislators are coming into House chambers. Senate President Gary Stevens and House Speaker Mike Chenault will preside over the session. This is Senator Begich's third speech to the Alaska legislature since he took office in 2009. He serves on the Senate Commerce, Veterans Affairs, and Armed Services committees. Earlier this week, he said he was apprehensive over U.S. involvement in Libya and the impact another military campaign will have on the U.S. budget, as well as other national security priorities. He will be talking more about federal spending in his speech. In just a few moments, they will escort the senator in the House chambers. We welcome both our radio and TV audience to this special broadcast. Following the senator's speech, he will take questions from legislators, and after that, there will be a press conference in the House Speaker's chambers. Last month, during Energy Council, when many legislators, about half of the legislature, actually traveled to Washington, they met with Senator Begich and Senator Lisa Murkowski on several issues, including the gas line and oil production. We do know that Senator Begich is going to be speaking about the gas line in his speech in just a few moments.
House, please come back to order. In accordance with the provisions of Uniform Rule 51, I turn the gavel over to the President of the Senate, the Honorable Gary Stevens.
Thank you. Will this joint session please come to order? Purpose of the joint session is to hear an address by the Honorable Mark Begich, United States Senator. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move and ask unanimous consent that the roll call of the Senate be waived and all members be shown as present.
Without objection, so ordered. Representative Osterman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move and ask unanimous consent that the roll call be waived for all members be shown in the House be present.
Without objection, so ordered. Will Representative Holmes and Senator Ellis escort the Honorable Senator Begich to the joint session?
Senator Begich will soon be escorted into the House chambers, where all members of the State Senate and the State House have sort of crammed in. The House chambers really only holds 40 people. There are two large galleries, and we know that many members of Senator Begich's staff have come with him.
From the great state of Alaska, the Honorable Mark Begich.
Thank you very much, and appreciate the opportunity to be here. President Stevens, Speaker Chenault, members of the House and Senate, and friends across Alaska, I'm happy to be home and honored for the opportunity to give what is my third presentation to the legislature. It was good to see many of you back in Washington, D.C. a few weeks ago, and thank you for all the hard work you did while you were there. I hope that you were not put off by the overly partisan atmosphere back there. It's not healthy for our country, and it's not healthy for our state. Several times in the past few months, partisan disagreements have threatened to shut down the federal government and stop the services and benefits it provides. It's unacceptable to me, and it should be to every American. Several of us are trying to buck the trend by reaching across political boundaries to get things done. Just a few weeks ago, I was pleased to partner with Senator Coburn from Oklahoma, one of the most conservative Republicans in the Senate, to save millions in taxpayer dollars by targeting unused orphan earmarks that are 9 years or older. With Republican Senator Johanns of Nebraska, we formed the bipartisan Senate General Aviation Caucus to work on aviation issues important to rural states where small aircraft are so important. And I also was proud to partner with Senator Thune of South Dakota to pass our first bill into law, which eases the burden on small businesses when it comes to identity theft safeguards. Of course, I work with my colleagues on my side of the aisle, too. I was the first Senate Democrat to call into question the burdensome 1099 tax reporting provision in the health care reform law. Now, because of bipartisan cooperation, Congress is about to strike this language once and for all. And I'm pleased to say, when it comes to Alaska, our congressional delegation is unified. Alaska is always put first. Before getting to the gist of my remarks, let me express my sympathies on behalf of all Alaskans to our neighbors in Japan. Alaskans are no stranger in the deadly impact of earthquakes, but the unimaginable devastation we are witnessing in Japan is heart-wrenching. My office is closely monitoring the situation there, especially the condition of the nuclear power plants, and I commend the many Alaskans across our state who are sending donations and prayers to our friends in Japan. Today, I want to talk about building Alaska's 21st century economy. As we have done so many times in our history, I believe it is vital that we as Alaskans assert our independence and determine our own destiny on Alaska's terms. We can't allow the internal strife, dictates from the federal government, or international events beyond our control to determine Alaska's future. Today, Alaska is at a crossroads. Thanks to the wisdom of pioneers who built our state and the rich bounty of our God-given natural resources, Alaska enjoys enormous wealth. It is the envy of every state in this country. And I will say I'm reminded of that every day in the Senate for my colleagues. $40 billion in our permanent fund, a $10 billion budget reserve, and limitless opportunities. Yet I believe our greatest asset is the entrepreneurial spirit of the independent-minded Alaskans, a can-do optimism that allows us to flourish in the face of great distances, extreme climate, and small, far-flung populations. Certainly, our future prosperity is not without challenge. Alaska's relationship with the federal government, a partnership which has accounted for about a third of our economy, is changing dramatically. Inaction by Alaskans on how to get our natural gas to market or how we improve our state's business climate could result in windows of opportunity slamming shut. And we know the international events beyond our control often impact us directly. Unrest in the Middle East that we are watching every day on TV has driven world oil prices to more than $100 a barrel, filling our state treasury. But many of us remember the devastating impact to our economy when those prices dropped to single digits. So we can't bank on our continued oil wealth. The unprecedented level of federal debt, nearly $46,000 for every man, woman, and child in America, means dramatic cuts in federal spending. We're already seeing the tip of the iceberg. with an end to the millions of dollars of earmarks that Alaskans have benefited from for decades. I strongly support federal spending cuts. I believe they start with members of Congress. It's why I opposed the pay raise for the last 2 years for members of the Senate, and we're already cutting our own budgets by more than 5%. It's past time to put aside our partisan differences and make the hard decisions. Alaskans demand we stop playing political games and do our job. And I am listening. I've already supported $51 billion of budget cuts for the current federal fiscal year, the biggest cut in federal spending since World War II. I've detailed out billions of dollars in additional cuts as a vital step to get our financial house in order. Make no mistake, for a state that ranks first among 50 states in per-person receipts of federal dollars, spending cuts will be felt across Alaska, even as we work to ensure that they are fair and carefully phased in. Alaska's half-century of love-hate relationship with the federal government continues unabated. There's no doubt Uncle Sam has helped to build the foundation for security and progress, roads, ports, military bases, health clinics. Yet every single day, I'm standing up to fight for Alaska, educating federal bureaucrats and members of Congress on our unique needs and challenges that we have here in our state. And when they are wrong, we fight them to try to correct their decisions, fighting the EPA and Army Corps over the refusal to allow oil development in the Petroleum Reserve, holding off congressional proposals to permanently lock up ANWR, battling efforts to impose a cookie-cutter roadless rule in Tongass, which restricts mining, hydro development, and timber harvesting. We have also had some successes fighting the federal government on permitting the Kensington Mine right here in Juneau, or Red Dog up in Western Alaska, permanent reauthorization of Indian Health Services, which hadn't been reauthorized in 19 years. And those are just a few examples where we're winning the battle. Starting with President Obama, I'll continue to tell federal officials when they're wrong on Alaska. And I'll keep working with you and the state of Alaska for a fair share in declining federal resources and for the right federal decisions on development in Alaska. Just like an earlier generation of Alaskans' refusal to surrender to federal dictates or to be bullied by outside special interests, so must we determine Alaska's destiny on Alaska's terms. Let me outline three areas where I believe we must focus our energies to build a strong and sustainable Alaska for the 21st century. First, we must continue to do all we can to make sure Alaska is on the cutting edge when it comes to resource development. Second, we must seize the enormous future opportunities in the Arctic. And third, we must transform technology-based economy, Alaska's technology-based economy, for the future. Everyone in this room knows oil fuels Alaska's economy. It fuels our state treasury, helps generate more than 110,000 Alaskan jobs, and produces generous dividends to Alaskans. But today, you know better than anyone, the North Slope production is at a record low, even threatening its continued viability of the Trans-Alaska pipeline. I share the concerns of Senator Murkowski, who warned here just last month that filling our pipeline is one of our state's greatest challenges and truly one of our nation's challenges. As popular as it is to beat up on the feds, the solution lies in developing Alaska's enormous oil and gas reserves on both state and federal lands and water. I'm encouraged by the interest in independence, such as Pioneer and Armstrong, and by large national companies like Eni and Reposal and Statoil, in prospects on state lands and near shore waters on the North Slope, or the most recent one, the Great Bear oil shale. Development south of Prudhoe Bay is also good news. An immediate focus should be on state lands around Prudhoe Bay with the so-called legacy fields, which hold over 4 billion barrels of oil. If Alaskans make the strategic business decision necessary to bring the investment and development dollars back to Alaska, I'm confident that oil can be produced. Making Alaska competitive means reversing the decline in production, putting Alaskans to work, and filling our coffers, and, of course, the permanent fund, with oil tax and royalty revenues. One of the biggest long-term prospects for filling the oil pipeline and reducing America's dependence on foreign oil is from the enormous reserves likely beneath federal lands and waters in the Outer Continental Shelf, the Arctic Refuge, and National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. These prospects alone are projected to hold 40 to 60 billion barrels, nearly a decade worth of total U.S. consumption. Senator Murkowski, Congressman Young, and I continue to fight every day for the opportunity to develop these resources for our nation. Just last week, I personally urged President Obama to direct federal agencies to cut the red tape in delaying Alaska development opportunities. Trust me, I don't let the President forget that he campaigned on the development of MPRA. In addition to regular use of the bully pulpit, I believe we must streamline the federal approval process. Next week, I'm introducing legislation to do that exactly. I'm proposing creation of the Federal Coordinator for the Arctic OCS, modeled after the legislation Senator Stevens passed, establishing a federal gas line coordinator. This office would have the authority to work across the agencies causing Alaska so much heartburn today. The EPA, Army Corps of Engineers, and the Interior Department. The federal OCS coordinator would work with the state of Alaska and the affected local governments to streamline development in the Chukchi and the Beaufort Sea, which holds such promise to the future of oil and gas development. My bill starts with the Arctic, but also allows similar positions for new areas of offshore development in the lower 48. At the same time, we have to address two different air permitting systems in this country. We have two standards, two processes, two different federal agencies overseeing air permits, one in the Gulf of Mexico and one for everyone else. This makes no sense. It's not fair, and it puts the companies with projects in the Arctic at a competitive disadvantage. We need to level the playing field. It's time to move all air permitting under the Interior Department. Senator Murkowski, Congressman Young, and I are focused like a laser beam on this. It may take legislation to fix it, and we're looking at every option available to us. Finally, there is one quick step the administration could take tomorrow to signal it is serious about increasing domestic oil and gas development. The President's climate czar recently left her job, apparently correctly reading the tea leaves that cap-and-trade legislation is not happening. Along with that, I asked the President to replace the climate czar with a development czar to help focus the administration on the right priorities to our nation on producing American energy from American soil with American workers. So good news for an Alaskan natural gas pipeline is the national focus of clean energy. Your congressional delegation is poised to do everything we can at the national level to get Alaska's gas to market, including increasing the federal loan guarantees for Gasline and cutting the red tape to move it fast once decided. I know you are waiting for a new report on an in-state gas line, the results of an open season, and hopefully reviewing the ideas like the one from David Godstein and as well as others. But from my perspective, I urge you not to wait too long. Our window of opportunity may be closing, and we must address this in-state energy need for Alaska and businesses and consumers now. The second major area of focus, which I believe is key to the prosperous 21st century and moving Alaska's economy and the future opportunities, is in the Arctic. I don't have to tell people like Senator Olson or Hoffman that Alaska is ground zero for climate change. Your constituents are seeing it and feeling it every single day. Alaska is well positioned to influence the new challenges and opportunities in the changing Arctic. A few weeks ago, I was honored to be named chair of the Senate Commerce Committee Subcommittee on Oceans, which covers the Arctic and atmosphere and fisheries, Coast Guard. This was known as the Alaska Committee. During the many years of the late Senator Ted Stevens chaired it because of its broad jurisdiction and vital resources that it brings to Alaska. There's no question we need more science about what's happening in the Arctic. Warmer temperatures, less ice, coastal erosion, disrupted fish and wildlife migration patterns, increased ocean acidification. These changes pose threats to the Arctic communities today, but also present new opportunities to address America's energy needs of tomorrow. To address these issues, I've introduced a package of bills designed to help Alaska adapt to these changes. They call for more research into the region's environment and species upon which residents of the North Slope depend on for subsistence. They also address oil spill prevention and response in the Arctic ice conditions, which is needed to move forward with energy development in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas. I will also use my position as chair of the Subcommittee on Oceans to fulfill the Coast Guard's infrastructure needs on the Arctic coast, including a deep water port and replacing our aging icebreakers. I also propose legislation to help pay for some of these Arctic research and infrastructure needs by leveraging the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund and provide community assistance through OCS revenue. It is truly time that we get our fair share of any OCS revenues that may be produced. Louisiana gets it, Alaska does not. My other bills would address the unique health needs of the Arctic, the ability of communities to adapt to the changing temperatures and ice conditions, and strengthen our international diplomacy when addressing matters with the Arctic nations. I commend the legislature's foresight in creating the Joint Alaska Northern Waters Task Force to focus on the many of the same issues that I just mentioned. And I look forward to working with Representative Chairman Reggie Jewell to capitalize on the enormous opportunities and the challenges of the Arctic. For Alaska to succeed in the fiercely competitive 21st century, we must get our Alaskans better prepared. 2 weeks ago in Washington, I was honored to chair a meeting with some of the nation's premier high-tech companies, CEOs of Cisco, Microsoft, UBS. They are the foundations of success. They said very clearly that the foundation of success in a new global economy is well-educated young people who excel in math, science, and computer skills. The message was loudly echoed by two Alaskans' homegrown high-tech entrepreneurs who participated in this meeting, and by many more who I visit across the state over the last 2 years. Like former Navy combat pilot Skip Nelson, an ADS of ADS-B Technologies based in Merrifield in Anchorage, Skip's team has been on the cutting edge of national aviation safety technology. They were selected to join FAA's core team to improve safety and bring greater efficiencies to America's air system. There's Colleen Riley, owner of Kachemak Research Development in Homer. Her company is developing an under-vehicle system used to inspect vehicles of several military bases. She now is working on a 5-year Air Force contract to enhance this technology, producing year-round, high-paying jobs here in our state. Another especially impressive cutting-edge Alaska company is an 8A firm, Alaska Native Technologies. Earlier this month, I visited the company, Anchorage's facility, where they are developing underwater, unmanned gliders for the Navy for research, intelligence, and security missions. ANT, as it is known, is one of the few high-tech manufacturing facilities in Alaska. But it highlights our incredible opportunities. Just last week, we helped the company receive a critical export license to sell gliders to South Korea, opening new avenues for international sales and export. Alaska's 21st century will flourish if we encourage more of these homegrown entrepreneurs to grow cutting-edge industries right here in Alaska. But it doesn't happen in a vacuum. The three key ingredients are education, the basic tools of modern commerce, and incentives for small businesses. First, education. To compete in the global economy, we must invest more in science, technology, engineering, and math, known as STEM. We are no longer in the top list of 10. We're no longer in the top list of 20. We're below 20 in the international arena when we think of these areas. If we want to be competitive in the 21st century, we have to invest in this education. That's why I recently introduced legislation in the Senate to boost these programs in these areas. This STEM legislation targets funds to high-need students in high-need districts, encourages out-of-the-box thinking, and supports professional development for STEM teachers. It is vital for Alaska because we know the current federal education law, No Child Left Behind, has been a disaster for our state. The second way to incubate more Alaskan innovators is with high-speed access to the internet. Even though Alaskans are frequent internet users, and I know that by all the emails I receive, we rank dead last among the 50 states on internet speed. This hampers our children's digital literacy and restricts small business development. That's why I'm using my position on the Commerce Committee to make sure broadband goes to both urban and rural communities. I helped secure over $100 million to expand broadband to Western Alaska, touching 120 villages in those areas of Bristol Bay and the YK Delta, so they have the same access as any other place that has high-speed internet for education, healthcare, and business development. Third, we must encourage growth of small businesses, the backbone of our economy, not only from the national perspective, but here in Alaska. In the past 15 years, small businesses have generated two-thirds of all new jobs in our economy. That's why I was a strong supporter of the Small Business Jobs and Credit Act, which recently passed the Senate in a strong bipartisan vote. It is estimated to create an additional 500,000 jobs nationwide. This measure provides full funding for small businesses, for small business loans, waives the capital gains tax on small business investment, and allows self-employed taxpayers to deduct their health care costs. All these steps create capital for small businesses, which they can invest in growing their operation and creating jobs. Here's an idea worth considering. As the legislature considers measures to lay groundwork for the 21st economy, I urge you to remember that old adage about hindsight being 20/20. If you think about one idea, invest a portion of the state's huge surplus as an incubator to encourage the development of Alaskan-grown high-tech industries and innovation. Many of you may remember the Alaska Science and Technology Foundation, established in 1988 when oil prices were one of their lowest points. But then, yet less than a decade later, it was liquidated for quick cash. I hear from entrepreneurs all across the state of the considerable value of such an enterprise to help encourage new technologies and industries. A modest state investment would go a long way toward leveraging federal and private dollars for these types of industries. Before concluding, let me say a few words about Alaska's servicemen and women. Part of my responsibility on the Senate Armed Services Committee is ensuring that our troops have the tools and training they need to do the job as they need. A few weeks ago, I was honored to spend time with more than 4,000 of our troops from Wainwright's 1st Striker Brigade Combat Team and the 25th Infantry Division at the National Training Center in the California desert. We landed at a mountaintop in a combat post, witnessed how the use of technology like retinal scans to identify a potential enemy, and enjoyed a delicious meal, an MRE meal together. That's not like your cafeteria here. It's a little different. But it was amazing to watch these young men and women. I've never seen a more impressive and more committed and high morale team of service members who are training for the front lines of Afghanistan. All Alaskans should be proud of who we have serving our country and who we have coming from Alaska. Please join me in thanking our great troops. It truly has been a great honor serving Alaskans as your senator for the past 2 years. Like everyone focused on the daily task of the jobs and family, it's challenging to keep the eye on the future big picture. I think that's the task of those in elected office, to work toward a common goal of building Alaska's economy for the 21st century. Our first responsibility is keeping our economy strong today by filling the oil pipeline and building the gas line with Alaska's enormous resources on both state and federal lands. Second, we must step up to the new challenges in the Arctic by better understanding the changes underway there and capitalize on them and the opportunities in resource development, transportation, and tourism. And we must assure Alaska's place in the global economy by educating our young Alaskans and giving our innovative entrepreneurs the tools to succeed and build a technology-based economy. I know we are Alaskans, as Alaskans, are up to this task. I thank you for the time. Thank you. God bless Alaska and our great nation. Thank you.
Questions. We'll begin with Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator, as everybody knows, we had a most disturbing incident that happened to a member of the State House and has happened to a number of Americans when they had to experience invasive body searches by the Transportation Safety Administration. And Representative Cisna was invited back to address the relevant subcommittee in the State House Homeland Security Committee. I know you're on the Senate Homeland Security Committee, and I'm wondering if you would consider asking the chair of that committee to hold a hearing in Alaska so Alaskans can describe the problems we have and why we're so concerned about these invasions of personal privacy.
Thank you, Representative Gruenberg. And let me first say, back in Washington, we were very proud to see Sharon on TV in that hearing laying out Alaska's issues from a very personal perspective. And without hesitation, that I'll be happy to ask the chairman for that type of committee, because I think it is an important issue. And Sharon, you have done a great job. So without hesitation, Max, I'll be happy to ask the leadership for that type of hearing here in Alaska. If I can add one thing, I got to say, and I've told this to Representative Cisna, she has already paved the way on some changes that you may not be aware of. And that is, when the incident occurred, we called TSA pretty quickly and said, you know, are you aware of this situation? They were, of course, because Sharon did a pretty good job in making sure everyone across the country was aware of it. Alaska is never off the map. But we asked them, what kind of training are you doing? And they talked about, you know, they talked to the FBI and talked to the public safety people. And I said, what about the people, for example, in Sharon's situation, or people who experience domestic violence or sexual assault or child abuse, or people who are experiencing disabilities? Are you talking to the advocates who work with these people so they can give you ideas on how to do better training? And the answer was no. And so what we found was they reached out and said, give us the list from your state of people who we could touch and help us improve our TSA training on a national level. So it's Alaska that's going to help with those issues, from not just from an Alaska perspective, so Sharon can get back in a reasonable time, but from a national perspective. So you are already making impact. And we were very excited because I think we're the only state that's offering up our resources to do that, in the sense of many nonprofit organizations that work in these areas, in these fields. So we're very excited about that, that they are open and listening. So thank you again, Representative Cisna, for what you've done.
Thank you, Senator Begich. Senator French has a question.
Thank you, Mr. President, and welcome to the House, Senator Begich.
He was confused where he was.
I was momentarily confused. You closed your speech with a nice tribute to our military, and I appreciate that. But I want to ask you on the same subject about the base realignment and closure process, which I understand is ongoing in Washington, and maybe you can tell us what you're doing to keep our bases open and thriving.
Well, thank you, Hollis. Let me say that I know there's a lot of discussion about, you know, as we deal with these spending issues, what's going to happen? Because as you know, the military budget is a significant portion of the federal expenditure. But I want to reassure you that in the review of what we're doing in regards to bases as well as international operations, at this point, there is no Alaska on the map in that sense. Sometimes we like to be on the map. This time we don't want to be on the map. But we're on the map. We're not on the map because We have been recognized as an important strategic post in the sense of our world obligations and our domestic security. We have been able to, when you look at in Anchorage or in Fairbanks, the investment that's going in now into our military bases, just in the President's 2012 budget and the way we've been operating in light of kind of the future, we saw it coming about when we felt 2 years ago when I came in the office that earmarks would be tough to get, that we started working with programs, trying to influence programs to make sure the investment was a continual basis. Well, in the President's budget for 2012, without any ads from us at this point, is almost $400 million of construction investment into the military in Alaska. That's a huge statement. We think because we've made our case, we have kind of arrived as a strategic post for the military, for our international efforts, we are here. Now the question is to make sure we do what we can to make sure these bases are very efficient. In Fairbanks, our challenge is energy costs and making sure the bases have the right kind of cost to maintain the facility. But we also have, and we're working with the general aviation community, J-Park, which is a huge training facility up there. But we want to make sure it works hand in hand with the general aviation community of the state. Why is that an important asset up there? Well, it's the largest open airspace in the country. And as we buy more and more unmanned aircraft, which is now we're in our third year of buying more unmanned aircraft than manned aircraft in the military, they have to have places to test them. Alaska is an incredible opportunity, especially if you note some of the companies I mentioned are using and developing that technology right here. So from my perspective, we're in one of the best times, even though we're in a tight budget constraint. Missile defense, we have now secured that for long-term funding, not just earmarks. Clear Air Force Base, those up in the interior. We will see in Clear Air Force Base probably over the next 5 years, $200+ million of investment. So in a lot of ways, we have kind of arrived in our position as a global security point for the country. So that is a real plus. Where we're focusing on, when people bring up the issues of BRAC, what we say is before you talk about domestic issues on that, we should look at international. What's our role internationally? Where are some of our bases? And do we have the right configuration out there? That's what we'd rather focus on than dealing with our domestics. And again, Alaska is in a much better position than we've ever been in.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Johansson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator, welcome back to Alaska.
Thank you.
In Southeast Alaska, many of our fisheries are dictated by federal, international, and interstate treaties, Pacific Salmon Treaty, and also decisions made by the International Pacific Halibut Commission, which you're very aware of, as I've forwarded all my phone calls to your office.
Yes, yes. We're very aware of it.
Our commercial fishermen have taken a 47% hit in allocation, and our sport fishermen are dealing with size limits. What can you say or let us know what you or your office is doing to give comfort to my constituents that in this area where we're very frustrated, where I personally can't do anything as a legislator, or our governor has a hard time because it's federal issues. Mm-hmm. Can you give my people some comfort as to what your vision is for the future for these two agreements, and what have you been doing to protect Alaska's interests?
Yeah, first, let me start on just the very narrow focus I can on the halibut. You know, we, Senator Murkowski and I have sent a letter very recently to talk about the size issue. If you're in the fishing end, size matters. And so we are sent a letter recently, but let me go to the global. Because of my new position as the chair of the Oceans Committee, which oversees fisheries, this is where we're going to have some say in the long term. I believe we just had a hearing, our first hearing 2 weeks ago, and we had kind of a review of the Magnuson-Stevens Act, and it was kind of just an update, but really it was for the folks on the East Coast to beat up on federal agencies because they have not had as much success as we have. Now, saying that, we have some great challenges, and one of the things we're going to do within our jurisdiction now is reach out to the fishing community in a much broader sense of what we can do to make sure, and there's going to always be, and I've learned this in all my years in Alaska, born and raised here, there's never settlement in the fishing wars. There's always fishing wars. The question is, how do we mitigate them so people can walk away with at least a feeling of some victory? And the federal government, because also in our committee, we not only have jurisdiction over fisheries, we have jurisdiction over NOAA. which is pretty significant when it comes to the fishing industry. So we will spend the time trying to figure out how to balance this from Alaska's interests. Everything we do in that committee, and this is interesting, when you're chair of the committee, and I chair two different committees, Alaskans are always at the table, and that's critical, because the fishing industries in the last 2 years, we've once in a while had Alaskans at the table, and I was not chair. It was a Washington senator. Now it's an Alaska senator, and now it's going to have a different deck of discussion, and I think that's going to be powerful for us. But we have a lot of work to do with the federal agencies. One of the biggest concerns we have right now in the spending issues is to ensure that, as you know, we spend a lot of resources on the federal end reviewing fishery stock and resources. We're worried that as the funding starts to get cut, they'll say, well, instead of reviewing that every year, we'll do it every 2 years. Well, that would be devastating to us. So our first battlefront is some of the, not, I shouldn't say they're smaller issues, but some of the very Alaskan issues. Halibut, it's the issue with the size of the halibut, the length of the halibut. That's one issue. But the broader is, how do we make sure that we have the resources still being put into it, into the fisheries industry, to make sure we do the right kind of science that helps us dictate and develop these plans or these treaties. As a chair of the committee, that's what I'll be doing. I can't tell you all the specifics, but as we reach out, we're going to have activities not only in D.C., but we'll have hearings here in Alaska on the fishing industry. And I'll be bringing some of my friends from the East Coast that may not be as familiar with Alaska fishing industry. I do remind them all the time how big we are compared to them and how they've messed up their fisheries, but our job is to show them how we do it right and also get them to be allies on many things. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Our last question will be from Representative Edgeman.
Thank you, Mr. President, and welcome, Senator Begich, to Juneau once again. I wanted to bring to your attention a situation in Unalaska Dutch Harbor regarding the EPA essentially mandating the community to build a secondary wastewater treatment. And the issue is basically twofold in terms of concern. One is the overriding budget, the cost it would incur by the community to actually build a facility, something north of $30 million. But second, that Unalaska is one of 76 communities that's on the Federal Register that might be called into having to provide the same type of infrastructure at a cost that that certainly the state can't afford, and from your comments about budget cutting back east, that the federal government probably can't afford. So just wanted to bring that to your attention and also see if you had any sort of observations or any comments you might be able to offer in that regard.
Sure. Thank you. That's not only a problem with Dutch Harbor. I will tell you, in the when I was mayor, this was, we have secondary treatment there. It's a $400 million headache, as I would call it. Here, I am aware of it. I think one of the issues we have with EPA, and, some days you like them, most days you don't. From our perspective, we're always kind of battling them. Most recent, to be very frank with you, I actually had a letter written to the EPA, and actually it was to NOAA and EPA, and it was concerned about some issues. And before the letter even left our office, they were already calling because they knew the letter was pretty harsh. And we sent it anyway. They, they tried to convince me not to send it. But I think in a lot of ways, EPA, we have a lot of work to do with EPA. They have expanded in a lot of ways. And I'll give you one example. Last year, when we were working on the oil and gas issues and we were trying to do a comprehensive energy plan, one of the things we've heard from the industry over and over and over again, that today EPA has this rule, then 3 years later they have a new rule, and the statute says one thing, someone else interprets it differently. And so what we did is we created within the legislation, agreed upon from the industry, from probably the most liberal part of our caucus to the most conservative part, on the language that would create an EPA preemption. What this would have meant on the oil and gas industry was, here's the rules. We all agree with them. And that's what they're going to be in law. That 3 years, 5 years, 6 years down the road, you can't have some new regulator come and say, well, I interpret it differently. These are the rules. This is what we stick with. With regards to the clean water issues in this case, there is a lot of debate going on in Congress right now. So we are aware of this, and what's happening is, more communities around the country are feeling this pinch because it's real money. This isn't something that you just go get some federal grant because we don't have the money. It's going to be passed on to ratepayers. And what's happening, as you can imagine, ratepayers are starting to hear about it and say, whoa, how much is this going to be? In some cases, tripling or quadrupling some of the bills. And you can imagine if you did that on any rate structure to an individual, you'd probably have a lot of calls coming in. So we are aware of it. And the good news about this, we're going to have allies not just in Alaska from our delegation, but across the country. How we're going to address this is not clear yet, because one of the things we're pounding away from our office is if you have a new rule or an interpretation of a rule, and I'll use Fairbanks as a great example. I think you had 50 out of your last 60 days in violation of the Clean Air Act. So they tell you, well, you need to go do something. Okay, so you're going to go do it, but it's going to cost you a lot of money. Well, they go to the Energy Department. I just use one example I know of. And the Energy Department says, well, we don't really have a grant for you to do that, even though we'd like you to do it. Well, you can't require and put these heavy burdens on and then have no opportunity, no resource to help solve this problem. And I think EPA has this problem with it when it comes to secondary treatment. And this is, you know, our numbers are small compared to other communities around the country. I mean, ours, you know, I know 30 million in Dutch Harbor is significant. 300 million in Anchorage is significant. But you just add a couple zeros of those for some communities around this country. So we're aware of it. We just don't know the right pathway yet, to be frank with you.
Thank you very much, Senator Begich.
This is Gavel to Gavel Alaska, with coverage of the Alaska State Legislature on the statewide 360 North Public Affairs Channel and on the web at www.gavelalaska.org. Gavel Alaska is sponsored by
the community of Juneau, providing TV and internet access from Alaska's capital city to all Alaskans.
ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Alaska Conference of Mayors, supporting access to all government for all Alaskans.
The Alaska Cruise Association, an Alaska-based not-for-profit organization, established to build strong partnerships between local businesses, communities, and cruise companies.
The Alaska State Employees Association, a union of 8,800 state and municipal employees living and working in more than 100 communities across Alaska. Alaskans working for Alaska.